I know last week several people asked me afterwards if I'm going to get to the rapture and so forth, and I had questions about that. And we will talk about that, but I want to give you a sense for where we're going. And let me again begin by saying my goal here, I know that maybe to some degree this is repetitive, it's meant to be. My goal here is for you to see the picture that the Old Testament paints in incredible detail. Most people, and I know this is true, most people, when they go to read the Old Testament prophets and the prophetic sections, are lost. It's an enigma to them. It's very confusing. And they in vain look for, they look for verses that they try to apply to their lives, and they pick out verses, and they have no sense at all of how they fit into the Old Testament picture. And I think that's a very dangerous thing to do. What I'm trying to do is to give you the picture that the Old Testament develops in incredible detail and incredible, it repeats itself often. And when you have that picture and you have that sense, you can go anywhere in the Old Testament, you can make sense of it. Okay, but many people are confused. So what I'm trying to do is give you the picture, and I'm building a house. And that's why it's going to be very difficult if you come 1 week and don't come for 2 weeks, and come, because it's not going to, you're not going to see the picture, okay? Not very well. So I encourage you to come week after week, because it does, it will, at some point, hopefully, the light bulb comes on and you see the picture. Because what I want you to see is when we get to the, when we complete the picture of the Old Testament, then when you come to the New Testament, you're going to understand that the New Testament is clearly building on the Old. And when you see the New Testament terminology and you see the New Testament passages, you're going to say, oh yeah, that's what that's talking about. Okay, the disciples understood that. We don't, because we don't understand the Old Testament very well. So what I want this to do is develop that picture. So what I'm doing tonight is looking again at the day of the Lord. And then I'm going to look at the kingdom. The kingdom that is developed in great detail in the Old Testament. Okay? And then I want to look at Daniel, because Daniel's the one thing that gives us time. It's the only book that deals definitively with time in the Old Testament. And then, eventually, we will get to the New Testament. So let me just briefly review what the Day of the Lord is. Can anybody tell me what the Day of the Lord is from last week? What is the Day of the Lord summarized in one word? Judgment. Wrath. It's the day of wrath. It's the day that God brings vengeance on his enemies. And when you look at the day of the Lord in the Old Testament, we looked at a few passages. We could look throughout the Old Testament. There are many passages that talk about the day of the Lord. And not just the ones that use the term. But in general, we'll see this tonight in one passage if we get there. The day of the Lord in the Old Testament often has a, if I can put it this way, a near and a far fulfillment. This is true in almost every day of the Lord passage. In other words, the prophet has something that's contemporary in mind. It might be the judgment of Babylon. It might be, like in the case of Joel, as we'll see tonight, a locust plague. Okay? It has something near in mind, but it's always pointing to the final day of the Lord. And that's a repeated phenomenon. And I think that's what's going on in Matthew 24, when Jesus gave his Olivet Discourse. But what I want to talk about tonight is the return of Christ as it relates to the day of the Lord. Okay? Because they are simultaneous. And the reason I'm pointing this out, and what I want to do is to help you to see that when you're in an Old Testament passage, there are many places where the second return of Christ is clearly given. And when you see that, you can give context to the passage. You can see the development of the passage in light of the return of Christ. You'll see what I mean. But I want to first of all go back, and I know we've read this some time back, and we'll read it again, but turn back to Revelation 19. This is the end of the tribulation. But hopefully, as I read this again, you will see things you didn't see the last time you read it. I don't remember when we read it. It's been a couple months, I'm sure. But as you read it, I want to point out the Old Testament imagery and terminology. You're going to see it again tonight. But this will help us, I think, see what I want you to see. Okay, this is starting in verse 11. And I saw heaven opened, behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. Now, there's no question who this is. This is obviously who? Christ. This is obviously Jesus Christ returning to earth. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems, and he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. He is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. Now, when you say that he is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, that ought to bring, to any Jew it would have, brought to mind many passages in the Old Testament that spoke of the day of the Lord. The vesture dipped in blood, that's how God often spoke of the day of the Lord, about himself, about being dipped in blood. Verse 14, and the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations. Again, a common theme in the day of the Lord in the Old Testament. And he will rule them with a rod of iron. What does that remind you of? Any particular passage from the Old Testament? Psalm 2. Okay. It says, he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God. Again, the winepress is the picture often in the Old Testament about the day of the Lord. The winepress, the idea of all the grapes gathered and squashed, and the juice comes out. That's a very graphic picture of blood being spilt in the day of the Lord. That's the wrath. That picture is given often in the day of the Lord in the Old Testament. Verse 16, and on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying, to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, come, assemble for the great supper of God. Now here again is Old Testament imagery. Often in the Old Testament, the day of the Lord is seen as a sacrifice, a supper. The Lord's sacrifice. This is day of the Lord terminology, all of it. So that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of commanders, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both free men and slaves, and small and great. And I saw the beast, and the kings of the earth, and the armies assembled to make war against him. Again, this whole concept of the armies of the world coming together at the return of Christ, a common theme in the Old Testament in relation to the day of the Lord. And it also speaks of the ultimate fulfillment, I think, of Psalm 2, when he says, why do the heathen rage? Okay, they're raging against Christ, who sat on the horse and against his army. Verse 20, and the beast was seized, and with him the false prophets, who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone, and the rest were killed with the sword, which came from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. Now, that's filled with Day of the Lord terminology from the Old Testament. I'm going to take you to the Old Testament in just a minute, but I just have to make an observation that I think is obvious. Okay? Look at verse chapter 20. Chapter 20 is the millennium. Okay? I wasn't going to say this, but I'll just throw this in. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he would not deceive the nations any longer. Now, people who believe in all millennialism, who say that that verse has already taken place and we're in that kingdom, that Satan is now bound, miss a really obvious point in the context. And that is in chapter 19, when the King of Kings comes, he destroys the nations who were deceived by the serpent. The whole point of the book of Revelation is, or not the whole point, but certainly a major point, is that the beast and the false prophet mentioned in verse 20 of chapter 19 were the ones who led the whole worldwide deception of Satan. In fact, beast refers to Satan sometimes and refers to the system other times. But the whole point is, he's not going to be able to deceive the nations anymore, starting in verse 1 of chapter 20. That obviously happens after Jesus comes to the earth. Okay? So all millennialism from the context is absurd. Okay? There's no way this could happen before chapter 19, which is what every all millennialist would have to say. Okay? It doesn't make sense in the context. That's for free. That wasn't my main point. My main point is to show you that chapter 19, verses 11 to the end, clearly speak of the return of Christ and clearly speak of the day of the Lord in the Old Testament. Now, why is that important? The reason that's important is because now, wherever you go to these texts, and there are many of them in the Old Testament, many, I'm not going to look at all of them by any means. When you see certain phrases and certain things, you know it's talking about this same event. So it gives you a starting point in the text. You know this is the day of the Lord. You know that the terminology used here in chapter 19 is clearly the fulfillment of the passage of the Old Testament. So you can see the return of Christ, the second coming of Christ, in many passages very clearly in the Old Testament. Let me give you an example. Go back. I'd love to go through all these passages because they're fascinating, but I don't have time. But I'm just going to read a couple. Deuteronomy 32. Okay? And Deuteronomy 32 is a very important passage. It gives us really an overview of eschatology. And I'm not going to go through that, but look at chapter 32. Again, this is the song of Moses. This is when God told Moses, he said, give the people this song because they're going to forsake me. They're going to go out, they're going to be thrown out of the land for a long time and suffer all the curses. And this is the song. This is all a prophecy. But he comes to the end of it in chapter 32, verse 41. This is day of the Lord terminology. If I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries, and I will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword will devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired leaders of the enemy. He is clearly here talking about the return of Christ. This is Revelation 19. All the terminology is there. Verse 43, rejoice, O nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and will render vengeance on his adversaries and will atone for his land and his people. Okay? Now, let me give you another example. Psalm 2:9. I'll just read it. I mean, you're familiar with this verse. You will break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. Now, that's talking about Christ. If you go back up, and I know we preached on this verse some time ago, but if you look at verse 6, God's talking about his son. And he says, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today have I begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give you the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. Now, I think many people refer those verses in verse 8 to evangelism today. I think it's a misunderstanding. This is fundamentally talking about the fact that he's going to take the kingdoms for himself. And when you have Jesus in Revelation getting ready to take the seals off, he is ready to proclaim his inheritance. He is getting his inheritance. Okay? He is inheriting the nations. He is receiving what God said he would give him. And what's happening in verse 9 is his return, which happens at the end of the book of Revelation. Okay, that's verse 9. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. That's the return of Christ. That's Revelation 19. There are other passages in the New Testament that refer to it. Isaiah 11. Actually, don't worry about that one because we're going to come back to that one. Go to Isaiah 24. This is also a Day of the Lord chapter. The end of it in verse 21. It says, "So it will happen in that day that the Lord will punish the host of heaven on high and the kings of the earth on earth. They will be gathered together like prisoners in the dungeon and will be confined in prison. And after many days they will be punished. Then the moon will be abashed and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and in his glory, and his glory will be before his elders." Now notice again, this is true almost 100% of the time in the Old Testament. I could take you to passage after passage after passage after passage. The reign comes after the day of the Lord. The kingdom comes after the day of the Lord. It's not before. Every all-millennialist has to put the kingdom before. In the Old Testament, it's always after. 100% of the time. And here's an example. Okay, you have the day of the Lord. The kings are judged. And then in verse 23, the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion. Okay, in Jerusalem. And his glory will be before his elders. Okay, but you understand how that terminology always gives you context then in the text. Okay, you know that's the return of the Lord because he's talking about the ultimate judgment. Okay, look at Isaiah 61. This is the passage that Jesus quoted in Luke when he was in Nazareth. And he said it's fulfilled. Notice in verse 1 of 61, he says, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives and freedom to prisoners, to proclaim the favorable day of the Lord." Now that is where Jesus stopped in Luke 4. He stopped reading in the middle of the verse. And he sat down and he said, "Today this is fulfilled in your hearing." Where he stopped is significant. He didn't read, "and the day of the vengeance of our God." Why? Because that didn't come yet. That day is the day that's talked about in Revelation 19. That's the day of wrath. The day of wrath is when Jesus comes. So in chapter 61, verse 2b is the return of Christ. When he says, "the day of vengeance of our God." Now, everything after this talks about after he comes. Okay? So, if we would go down through this, verse 3, "to grant those who mourn in Zion, giving them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of spirit of fainting, so they will be called the oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. They will rebuild the ancient ruins, they will raise up the former devastations, and they will repair the ruined cities." This is Jeremiah 33, Jeremiah 31. Okay, all of this happens after the day of vengeance. And he goes down through and gives all this, the rest of the chapter is kingdom terminology. Okay. I think he's talking about the preaching of the gospel. And that is the aspect, by the way, of the kingdom that came in the New Testament. And we'll talk about that when we get to the New Testament. Okay. The aspect of the kingdom that came in the New Testament was the preaching of the gospel, salvation, spiritual salvation, and the Holy Spirit. In that sense, the kingdom was inaugurated. But these kingdom promises that follow the day of vengeance do not refer to the church, and they do not refer to today. They're future. And they form our understanding of eschatology. Or look at chapter 63, verses 1 through 6. We have, again, clear statement of this is the return of Christ. All the terminology is here. "Who is this who comes from Edom with garments of glowing colors from Bozrah? This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads in the winepress?" That's Revelation 19. "I have trodden the wine through alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them with in my anger and trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. I looked, and there was no one to help, and I was astonished, and there was no one to uphold. So my own arm brought salvation to me, and my wrath upheld me. That is the return of Christ. That's the day of vengeance. That is Revelation 19. And we'll look at Joel. Well, let's go there. I want to look at Joel, but I don't know how much we'll get through. But since we're working on this, let me just read Joel 3. Joel's an important book in terms of eschatology. Joel 3, this is another statement of Armageddon and the return of Christ. Chapter 3, verse 12, let the nations be aroused and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. By the way, Jehoshaphat means Jehovah judges. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, tread, for the winepress is full. Again, that's Revelation 19 terminology, the winepress. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon grow dark, and the stars lose their brightness. The Lord roars from Zion. This is His return. This is the return of Christ. And utters His voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth tremble. But the Lord is refuge for His people, and a stronghold to the sons of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Notice again, what comes right after it? The kingdom. Dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. So Jerusalem will be holy, and strangers will pass through it no more. And in that day the mountains will drip sweet wine. Again, it's all kingdom terminology. The kingdom comes after the day of vengeance. Every time. It's repeated over and over again. And we could look at Zechariah 14. We'll look at that. I think we looked at that last week a little bit. So let me just stop there for just a moment and ask you, do you have any questions about what I've said so far? Does that make sense to you, what I just said? When you see that clear terminology about the day of the Lord and vengeance and all, a lot of what links it is the metaphors, the winepress, the sickle. Those refer ultimately to Revelation 19, and when Christ comes, that always puts you in a particular place when you read an Old Testament text. Does that make sense? Well, it varies in every situation, and we'll see if we have time tonight. I'm hoping to get through Joel. We'll see that in Joel. It's clear. It's very clear in Joel. It's different in different contexts. It's always different. In Matthew 24, it was AD 70. In Matthew 24, the near was Jerusalem destroyed by the Romans. Okay, but it's clearly pointing to Revelation 19. I mean, that's obvious in the text. Well, my only response, I mean, there are a lot of things like that in Revelation. When you say allegorical, well, I mean, what is it going to actually look like? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be one of those things when it happens that the world will say, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But it's literal in the sense that the world is going to be opposed to Christ. And He is literally going to come down from heaven, because we know that from when He left. He said, in like manner, I'm going to come back. And to the same place, I might add, the Mount of Olives. Okay. So while there's a lot of language that's very ornate and symbolic in the book of Revelation, I would say fundamentally, there's no question we have to say this, that what happens in the book of Revelation is going to be the worst time to be alive in human history. It will be bad. A lot of people underplay the violence of Revelation by saying it's all, you know, this is all symbolic language, and it's going to be horrible. Okay, the day of the Lord is going to be a violent day, and the people of the world will know it is the wrath of God. Okay, and I really, well, I'm getting off on So, but I think I really do believe that much of what's being promoted in the movie theater, to be very frank, I think is preparing people for this day. They will fight against God. They will see him as the enemy. And I could give you examples of why I think that is, but that's not a subject. No. Technically, the day of the Lord is a broader... It's. You understand, when we say day can be used in a broader sense. In the Old Testament, when you see day, if you want to know if it's a literal day, there are several ways to know. One way that you know is if a cardinal number is added to it. If you say the second day or the third day. Generally, I mean, if you look at the context, that's almost always a point that it's a real literal day. But when you see day just generally used, I mean, that's like saying, you know, in the day that I go to Heinen's. Well, that's not necessarily pointing to a, you know, maybe that's not a good example. But, it could point to a whole period of time when it's used just generically. So I would not say it necessarily points to a single day, although certainly the return of Christ is climactic. But there's more than just the return of Christ included in the day of the Lord in prophecy. So it's not just a day. Yes, Nancy. That's a good question. I'm not prepared to say beyond a shadow of a doubt that every passage has a near fulfillment. I know many of them do. Many of them, if you read the context, it's obvious. If you read, I think it's chapter 13 of Isaiah, it's clearly talking, I mean, it's about Babylon. But it's obviously also pointing beyond Babylon. And many of them are like that. I won't say that all of them are. Like I would say, for example, Joel chapter 3, is clearly only talking about the day of the Lord, the ultimate day of the Lord. So I would say that not every passage. Any other questions? Okay, what I want to do now, I'd like to go through three passages. I don't think I'll get through three of them tonight. The first two, hopefully, I'll get through. And my goal in doing this is to help you to see how to read prophecy. And I think it's almost what I'm trying to do is actually work through verse by verse some of these passages, and I'm picking three that are most important, I think, in regard to the return of Christ. And what I want you to see is the pattern, okay? Because this pattern is repeated over and over again, but it's seen, I think, in these three passages in particular very, very well. Isaiah chapter 11, I want to actually work through the whole book of Joel in kind of an overview, and then next week, Lord willing, we'll look at Zechariah 12 through 14. Because in all of them, the return of Christ is clearly seen. And in all of them, there is a great deal of other things that come to play, and you see the relationship. Okay. So, turn over to Isaiah chapter 11. Now again, hopefully as you... And I realize I'm going to, along the way, hopefully tie things together. But hopefully as you read some of these things, you know, some of the passages that we looked at in the past come to mind, like Jeremiah 31 to 33, and Ezekiel 36, and Ezekiel 37, and all the covenants that are in the Old Testament. But I know I read this before, but I want to actually... Now, what I did with Isaiah is I actually broke it out. I actually give the text in the NASB here, and what I did was I kind of defined it. And then on the far right, I give parallel passages. And I just want to work through this to help you understand what you're reading when you read a passage like this. And hopefully this is helpful. So let me begin. This is Isaiah chapter 11. And I'm just going to read it and talk about it. Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what he sees, nor make a decision by what he hears. This is clearly referring to the first coming of the Messiah. Okay? Now, how do I know that? Well, really, fundamentally, it's the beginning when it says, then a shoot will spring. It's the exact same picture of Isaiah 53. Turn over to Isaiah 53. I know we've been there. But look at Isaiah 53, verse 1, or verse 2. Speaking of the servant, the Messiah, it's the same kind of terminology. For he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of a parched ground, he has no stately form or majesty that we should look on him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. And the point of the passage was that he was going to kind of come up almost unnoticed, like a little sapling, and no one even know who he was, insignificant. He would just show up, and you know, no one would take any notice of him. That's the picture. That's the same picture here in chapter 11, verse 1. A shoot will spring up from Jesse. Okay, this is talking about his first coming. And then he says, the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. Now that reminds me of Luke chapter 2, where you know it talks about how Jesus grew in wisdom and knowledge and so forth. Okay, this is clearly talking about his first coming. Again, how do I know that for sure? Well, the passage we read in Isaiah 61, which Jesus referred to himself in the first coming. Verse 1 of chapter 61, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives. Okay, that's parallel. This is his first coming. And then in verse 4, he says, but with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted on the earth, and he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Now there, that's the obvious turning point in the passage. That's obviously the second coming of Christ. Now you understand, a Jew reading this in Old Testament times didn't understand that there was a break there. Okay? The Jews did not clearly understand that there were two comings. Okay? Which is one of the reasons they were confused. And it even says in 1 Peter chapter 1 that they were trying to figure out how this suffering stuff fit in with this glory stuff. Okay? They didn't think of it in terms of two comings. And so passages like this often have an abrupt break. We see it now looking back. They didn't. But this is the break in the passage. Okay? This is now talking, everything after this is now following his return. Okay? So everything after this is not the church. It can't be. It's future. When he comes. When he returns. Everything after this is future. Okay? So, and I give a lot of parallels. I won't go to all of them. I mean, I'll go to a few of them maybe. And there are many more that could be given. Okay, now verse 5. Yes. With an amillennial reading? You know, I was looking at all millennial commentary in this passage before I came, and I was a little confused. And I think different ones would do it differently. Some, I think, would apply these verses to heaven. And some, I think, would apply them to today. I'm not sure there's a specific amillennial reading. I will tell you that one of the confusing things about amillennial writing when it comes to the Old Testament is they tend to neglect, I can't say it across the board, but they tend to cut the passages up. They don't give a real good order oftentimes, or keep the order. They oftentimes break them up, if that makes sense. But to answer your question, I would say they either refer it to heaven or they refer it to the church today. Okay? And I'm not going to, I mean, I haven't read enough all millennial commentaries to say this is across the board what they do with it. But you understand, when you say the kingdom, okay, when you say the kingdom is now, and that the kingdom is fulfilled in the church, to be consistent in all sincerity, you have to say these promises afterwards are today and refer to the church, which is what many of them do. Okay? Which I think is abominable in relation to the context of the passage. This is obviously after the return of Christ. And this isn't something that's once in a while. This is the consistent order always. Okay? So, verse 5. Also, righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. Now again, this is referring to something given in great detail throughout the Old Testament, his righteous reign on the earth. His righteous reign on the earth begins after he comes. It's not before. He's not on the throne of David now. He's not reigning over the nations right now. He is at the right hand of the Father waiting, Psalm 110:1. He's waiting. He's waiting to come and take his inheritance, which he will do, and when he does, he'll reign. Then he will reign on the throne of David. Now, turn over to Isaiah chapter 32. These are some. I'm going to give you some parallels. Okay. Isaiah chapter 32, verse 1. Behold, a king will reign righteously, and princes will rule justly. And then look at verse 16. Speaking of that time, then justice will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness will abide in the fertile field. And the work of righteousness will be peace, and the service of righteousness, quietness, and confidence forever. Or, you could look at Jeremiah 23, which we've looked at before. I'll just read that verse. Chapter 3, verse 5, or chapter 23, verse 5. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. Now listen, whenever you hear that terminology, you know you're talking about the kingdom. And you know you're talking about that time when after Christ returns and he's on the earth. Okay? And if I'll throw this in, I'll say this again, but just to throw it out. This is one of the reasons I believe in a rapture. If you look at 1 Thessalonians 4 and 5, we go up. That's the only place, except for maybe John 14, which I also think is talking about the rapture, and 1 Corinthians 15, which I think is talking about the rapture. That is the only place people go up. In the Old Testament, it's always they come down, and they stay down. Nobody goes up, and there is no resurrection. Okay? So there is a contrast. I'll develop that eventually. But that's one of the reasons I clearly believe in a rapture. Because what you have and what post-tribulation raptures always have to do is have the saints going up and coming right down because they come back with the Messiah. It doesn't make sense. Okay? The reason I believe in a rapture and a pre-tribulation rapture is because we go up. And in that passage, Jesus never comes to the earth in 1 Thessalonians 4. We meet him in the air and we go to be with him forever with the Lord. Yeah. No. I would say what marks the beginning of the day of the Lord. Well, I would say that it's one of the first things, yeah. I'm not going to say it's the very first thing, but certainly I would say that the rapture of the church coincides closely to the day of the Lord, but I'll talk about that more. We'll talk about that. That is, yeah, I do believe that that takes place soon after. We'll talk about that. I don't want to get off on the rapture, but I just threw that in because of what we're talking about here. So we have the righteous reign on the earth. Now, verses 6 through 9. Again, this is classic kingdom terminology. There are several places in the Old Testament that speak of this kind of thing. And the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. Also the cow and the bear will graze. Their young will lie down together, and the lions will eat straw like the ox. The nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now, let me just point out several things about this. First of all, notice this is obviously the reversal of what? The curse. At least this part of the curse anyway. I mean, at least we know that animals are dwelling together. Okay. no longer do bears eat other animals. They eat grass. Okay, that's a reversal of the curse. Okay. Notice this is after the righteousness reigns. Again, this is consistent. Always, always, always in the Old Testament, you have righteous reign and then peace on the earth. I mean, that's what you see in Isaiah 32, 16 and 17, which we just read. Righteousness will bring peace. Okay? That's the kingdom. Yes. Yes, correct. It's hard for me to keep everything in order here, but I'll try to keep from going off on rabbit trails. The peace aspect is repeated almost ad infinitum in the Old Testament. We will look at kingdom, but I want you to notice another thing, and notice where at the end in verse 9, where it says for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Listen, that is not talking about the growth of the church. This is after the return of Christ. We are not living in that day. I'll point this out some more. Verse 10. Then in that day, the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. Now, this is another important point related to what I just said. Notice that all of the passages in the Old Testament that speak about the Gentiles coming to the holy Mount of Zion are always related to post-Christ's coming. They're not referring to the church. All of these passages come after the return of Christ. So what's going to happen after Christ returns? He's going to judge the nations, but clearly some of them will be left. I think this is the goat and sheep judgment in Matthew 25. Some of them go into the kingdom, some of them don't. Okay. But clearly, okay, when the kingdom comes, there are going to be Gentiles on the earth, and they are going to come to Zion. Okay, that's the order always in the Old Testament. So that the church is not the fulfillment of this passage. The picture of the kingdom after Christ returns is always that the Gentiles will come to Jerusalem. And they will... And by the way, these passages lose all meaning if it becomes the church. Because then who are the Jews? The Jew-Gentile distinction is maintained in the kingdom. And if you turn those passages into the Jews being the church, well, then who are the Gentiles? And if you turn the Gentiles into the church, who are the Jews? And those are the kinds of problems you have with amillennialism and with spiritualizing the Old Testament. It sounds great as like a broad concept, but when you actually get into the text, it doesn't work. It is awfully confusing. Okay, so who are the Jews and who are the Gentiles? Are the Gentiles the church or the Are the Jews the church? No, there is a Jew-Gentile distinction in the kingdom. That doesn't mean we're not part of Abraham's seed spiritually. It simply means there is diversity within the unity of the one people of God. I can put it that way. But at any rate, understand that the Gentiles in the millennium are going to come to Jerusalem. This is after the return of Christ. Verses 11 and 12. Then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people, who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. The islands of the sea is a way of saying all around the earth. And he will lift up a standard for the nations and assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Again, something that is restated so often in the Old Testament, the passages I list there are by no means all of them. And by the way, when you come to Matthew 24, 31, and it says he gathers the elect from the four corners of the earth, a Jew knew exactly what he was talking about. He was talking about these passages. He's talking about the regathering of Israel. That will happen when Christ returns. It's always consistent. Okay, verse 13. Then the jealousy of Ephraim will depart, and those who harass Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. Now again, this is something that's talked about a good deal in the Old Testament. We read sometime back Ezekiel 37, which, remember, Ezekiel took God had him take two rods, and he joined them together into one rod. Do you remember that? Ezekiel 37? And he said, the day is coming when Ephraim and Judah will be one, and they will be one in my hand. And then he goes on and talks about all the kingdom promises. Okay? That's what he's talking about here. It's parallel to Ezekiel 37. And what he's saying is, there's no longer going to be a division. There's going to be one Israel. Now again, if you make this the church, well, what does Judah and Ephraim mean? And how does Judah and Ephraim fit into Gentiles? It makes no sense. You can't make this work. Yeah.
Does that make Ephraim Jewish?
Yeah. Ephraim is the son of Joseph. And Ephraim is often used in the Old Testament to refer to the northern kingdom. Ephraim was when he often referred to the northern kingdom, you know, after there was the split between Judah and Ephraim. The northern kingdom is often referred to as Ephraim. Hosea is probably the best example of that. But this is something that happens after Christ returns. And then verse 14. Again, this is another common theme in Old Testament prophecy. They will swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west. Together they will plunder the sons of the east. They will possess Edom and Moab, and the sons of Ammon will be subject to them. And this is simply all her neighbors. All the ones who have provoked her, she is going to rule over. Israel shall reign over her enemies. And this is, again, a theme throughout. And I won't look at all these passages, but look, I think one of them that's interesting is Psalm 60. Now, the reason I'm doing this, I'm trying to help you get a feel for how to look at prophecy. I hope this helps. And one of the reasons I put this out on the paper is so that you can refer back to it if you so desire. But look at Psalm 60, verse 8. This is a psalm of David. And I think ultimately he's talking about this day. Moab is my washbowl, over Edom I shall throw my shoe. Shout loud, O Philistia, because of me. Now, all of those men are mentioned in this passage in Isaiah chapter 11. Who will bring me into the besieged city? Who will lead me to Edom? Now, this is David speaking, but I think it's David as a type of Christ. Verse 10, Have not yourself, O God, rejected us? And will you not go forth with our armies, O God? O give us help against the adversary, for deliverance by man is in vain. Through God we shall do valiantly, and it is He who will tread down our adversaries. That time when God will tread down her adversaries is the day of the Lord. That's the day of the Lord terminology. That's what he's speaking of here in Isaiah 11:14. He's talking about the day when he returns in vengeance and takes vengeance on Israel's enemies, and Israel reigns over her enemies. Okay? Very consistent. Very consistent. We could look at Balaam's prophecy in Numbers, which is fascinating in relation to this. It speaks of the same thing. It speaks of the day when Judah will roar like a lion and she'll rule over the nation. Verses 15 and 16. And the Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt, and he will wave his hand over the river with his scorching wind, and he will strike it into seven streams and make men walk over dry shod. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of his people who will be left, just as there was for Israel in the day that they came up out of the land of Egypt. And this is kind of a summary. This is a summary of what God's going to do for Israel. All of this is after the day of the Lord, or after the day of vengeance. And again, it's another example of which I've pointed out many, of comparisons with the Exodus to that day. And you see it in many places where you see that the day of Christ's return is compared in terminology very similar to the Exodus from Egypt. Okay, and that's the terminology he uses. Now, it's 7:30. I really wanted to go through Joel. I obviously am not going to. Do you have any questions? Does this make sense, Wes? Well, they believe that that's the return of Christ. There's no question about that. But what they would do, and again, I can't speak for all of them because there's many variations. But I say many, I mean some. But what they would do that I would say is exegetically just impossible is they make chapter 20 happen before chapter 19. They would say that that's a flashback. And that refers to us today, reigning. And exegetically, that is... it's impossible. Contextually, the language, it's just impossible. And the more you study it, the more obvious it is. The other thing that I would disagree with, and probably most amillennialists, is that they would make chapter 6 through chapter 18 coextensive with the church age, by and large. Which, is, again, doesn't make sense to me because now you have the day of wrath extending over the whole period of the church age. Which doesn't make sense. Yeah. Well, that's a very good question. And the answer to that is, I'm not sure. I mean, ultimately, we know that every single person is judged in the day of judgment. And I don't know if this helps you, if this will help you, but let me explain what I think is expanded in the New Testament that might help you. First of all, you do have the concept clearly in the Old Testament that that is the case, that not every unbeliever is destroyed, okay, at that point. Whether it's let me change that. I would say it's people who do believe. There are going to be Gentiles that come to faith in the tribulation. That's clear in the book of Revelation. And some of those are going to survive to the end. I would say that that everybody that enters the millennium will believe in Christ. Okay? And that will start the millennium. But something that I think, I don't know if this helps you or not, but in the Old Testament, what you have is the day of the Lord, okay, the day of vengeance. Okay, the day of vengeance, God comes down and judges his enemies, and then you have the kingdom, okay? And this kingdom extends forever. And that's the language. He's going to come, he's going to reign on the earth, and that kingdom is going to be forever. They're going to be in the land forever. Okay? Now, amillennialists or, you know, non-dispensationalists, I guess maybe I should say, generally say that, or non-premillennialists, would say that that is heaven. And they're half right. The reason I say they're half right is because in the Old Testament, I think I can show you this pretty clearly in the next few weeks. In the Old Testament, the millennium and heaven are never separated. I can show you distinctions, okay? But it's never clearly separated. It's just kind of like, here's the day of the Lord, and the kingdom comes, and they live happily ever after on the land. What is new in the New Testament, and what is not seen in the Old Testament clearly, is what happens. This here kingdom in the land, it starts out with the kingdom. Jesus reigns, okay, for 1,000 years, as it says in Revelation 20. And then there is a rebellion at the very end of that period. And then there is the great white throne judgment, okay? And then there is the new Jerusalem comes down to heaven, to the land, and you have eternal state. That is what is revealed in the New Testament. Now, in the Old Testament, what you don't have is a clear 1,000-year and then a judgment at the end. That's not clear in the Old Testament, but what is clear in the Old Testament is that during the kingdom age, it's not a perfect age. There is still death. It says that he who dies at 100 years old, says in Isaiah, will be as an infant. Okay, you're going to have longevity, but you're still going to have death. And you still have sin. So there's going to be a certain amount of people in the millennium who aren't perfect. Now that, again, people have a real problem with that, but that's what the New Testament outlines. That's how it's outlined. Global warming is a fear tactic. Now, the globe is warming, but it's not because of us. Okay? The amount of CO2 we put in the air is so small compared to the trees and volcanoes and everything else. It's absurd to think that we could. That's another subject. But Nancy, I think you had a question. You know, it's not quite as simple as saying denominations, because it's just not that simple. But generally, you could probably say Presbyterian, Reformed traditions generally are all millennial or postmillennial. But, you know, having said that, the dispensationalists came out of Presbyterian. You know, a lot of the Dallas theological guys were Presbyterian, which I don't think people know that, but it's true. So there are. It's not as simple as saying, you know, but generally speaking, covenant theologians, which would include the Reformed tradition generally, is amillennial or postmillennial. They so revere Calvin and Augustine, and, you know, they're next to the Apostle Paul oftentimes. And so they just, you know, that is honestly, that's who they quote. I would say the Catholic generally is amillennial. But you know, I don't know that they even teach much in regard to eschatology. But you understand, amillennialism was kind of also hijacked by the liberals. And the reason I think that's true is because amillennialism, now there are exceptions to this, but generally speaking, amillennialism is very, what's the word? Ethereal? Is that the word? You know, they talk about a physical king, they talk about the physical, and then they talk about the spiritual. And the spiritual is kind of this vague thing. What is the spiritual kingdom? You know, what is heaven? Is it? I mean, when you say it's spiritual as opposed to physical, and it kind of turns into this ethereal, almost undefined, amorphous thing. What is the kingdom? Well, it's spiritual. Well, okay, it is spiritual, but it's also physical. And even the... But I say that because the liberals kind of got onto that. They like that because it's very undefined, very vague, very Platonic, really. I mean, because Plato taught that the physical is evil and the spiritual, or mind, is good. And so it was actually, salvation was being released from the body. So when you died, it was actually a kind of salvation because you were freed from the evil body, the physical, the lower, the unimportant. And that's not at all the biblical model. The biblical model is that the physical and the spiritual are together forever. We're going to be in physical bodies forever, on a physical land, on a physical earth. Heaven is on earth. It's not out there somewhere in some vague, you know, ethereal cloud somewhere. We're going to be on earth. We're going to be on land. We're going to eat and drink. And I really strayed from answering your question. Did I answer your question? No, I can't say that at all. They're very intelligent men. They're very, many of them are very godly men. I mean, I'm not going to say... No, it comes down to the, and this is why I'm. This is one of the reasons I'm doing this in the Old Testament, because I want you to see the difference. The difference is fundamentally this: they see the Old Testament through Augustinian eyes, and what I mean by that is they apply all these kingdom promises to the church. So they spiritualize everything. Okay, and I'll try to explain that when we get to the New Testament. I'm getting ahead of myself. But if I can develop the picture in the Old Testament, and you get the picture, and you get the light bulb, even if you disagree with me, you will understand why you disagree with me. Okay, that's what I want to get you to the point. Okay, I don't, you know, disagree with me, that's fine, but I hope you understand why you disagree with me. What is the difference? And that is the difference. Okay, we'll talk about that. No, because we haven't had any new prophecy. I mean, the next thing on the horizon, prophetically, is the return of Christ. And, you know, I think we have things in the New Testament that clearly tell us what signs to look for, if I can put it that way. We ought to be able to discern that we're in the last days, I think. But there is no specific prophecy that says, okay, this must happen before Christ returns. Christ could come. And that's the way God designed it. It was meant to be imminent. I think the apostles really believed that it was going to happen in their day. But it was designed that way. Yes. That was huge. But I would still say that that was something that there's no clear statement that Israel would become a nation before the tribulation in Scripture. I think what happened was when this happened, it kind of was almost a fulfillment of what they were saying had to happen, that the Jews would come back to the land, and they did. I think it's interesting, some of the Spurgeon sermons that I've read about his understanding of the Jews, he said very plainly he believed the Jews were going to come back to the land, and you know the kingdom was going to be given to them, and that they were going to dwell in the land. And I mean, everything I'm saying here, Spurgeon believed that. And I think it's interesting because he was preaching just as the Zionist movement was just starting to bud. I don't know if he was aware of it, but I mean, that was when it was starting to bud, that they were actually starting, Jews were starting to talk about the land, and they were starting to talk about a place going back to, you know, some place, and you know, Israel was one of the options for Palestine. And then of course what happened, and this was set a lot of the date setting, because in Matthew 24 Jesus said, when the fig tree, you remember, he talked about the fig tree blossoming. Fig tree refers to Israel. That's pretty clear in the context. But he was saying, this generation shall not pass till all this be fulfilled. A generation is 40 years. So people started going 40 years from 1948 and said, see, 1988, you know, had to be the year, and you know, that kind of thing. You can do that pretty easily with scripture numbers. But the point is, I don't think 1948 was the fulfillment of all of these prophecies of the regathering of Israel. I would say it's the beginning of it, but it's not the fulfillment of all of this. I would say it's prophetically significant. But maybe the dispensationalists have made too much of it. Any other questions? All right, well, next week, and maybe if you want something to read, read the book of Joel. And I'm going to go through that and just go through, I don't know if I'll get through Joel and Zechariah, but we'll go through at least Joel. And we'll go through and again, you see a lot of the same kinds of things in the book of Joel, and we'll look at that next week. All right, let's pray. Father, we bow before you. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the depth and the wonder of your plan. And Lord, my prayer is that through this we would